The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Two Chairs No Waiting, episode number 681, From Lucy to Mayberry and Beyond. Two Chairs No Waiting is brought to you by folks just like you. We have a high sheriff of Two Chairs No Waiting for episode number 681. It's Chris Merrill. And the executive producer of episode number 681 is Mike McGonigal. Thank you both for your support of Two Chairs No Waiting. I really do appreciate it. And I want to thank you for being here with me for another night or another day, whenever you're listening, here in Mayberry. I'm Alan Newsom, the host of Two Chairs No Waiting, and it is great to have you with us here, and thank you to the Mayberry Band for our theme song. It's always great to be in Mayberry and just to visit and talk and have some fun. And we've got something really special this episode now. This is back Granville, Tennessee. Granville, Tennessee has an annual Mayberry I Love Lucy Day, and this year's was held back on April the 9th, 2022. And the special guest for the main event, for the big deal, was a man who played Opie's buddy, Johnny Paul, as well as Little Ricky on I Love Lucy. And man, what a great bridge between those great classic television shows. Now, if you'd like to, you can go back in episode number 295 of Two Chairs No Waiting features Keith. So if you want to go back and listen to that, you're more than welcome. It was recorded at the Mayberry Squad Car Rendezvous back in 1995. And so we spent about 25 minutes or so talking to Keith in that episode. A great episode. And he goes into a lot of detail in it about the Andy Griffith Show. So this particular conversation we're going to have with him is what he presented at the Mayberry I Love Lucy Day Festival in Granville. And I know you're going to really enjoy this because he talks about the Andy Griffith Show, but he talks about his whole career, you know, how he got started, why, you know, playing the drums, how he got started as Little Ricky, moving to the Andy Griffith Show, troubles he had in his life and the redemption that he got from, during that journey and the joy that he's gotten from it. It's a great interview. Now, this is going to be a fairly long episode. So we're going to hear from Keith, and then we're going to hear from Spirit Walker returning to Mayberry. And his, it's called Carmen to Guitar Men. So you'll want to stick around for that too. I hope you're really going to enjoy this episode. I know I really enjoyed hearing Keith give his presentation, and I believe you are going to as well. So because it's going to be a long one, I'm going to head right on in and let's go and hear from Keith from Granville, Tennessee, back on April 9th, 2022.
We have Keith Devedeau here with us. As I'd said earlier, this is the Mayberry I Love Lucy Festival. And Keith was Little Ricky on I Love Lucy, and then Opie's buddy, Johnny Paul Jason, on the Andy Griffith Show. And I've met him many times now over the years as a big Mayberry fan that I am. And it is so wonderful to have him here with us. He's going to be playing some drums for you because, you know, he really plays. That was one of the reasons he got the role, I believe. But he's going to be able to answer some questions, tell you some stories, entertain you for a while here with us, and we are so lucky to have him with us. So let's give him a big hand. And Keith.
Oh gosh, thank you, Alan. Hey, let's give Alan and Rick a hand for what they did. That was awesome. The tribute artists, all the tribute artists are amazing that help with keeping the flame going around here. But my name is Keith Thibodeau, like Alan introduced me to you guys. And he was reminding me of a story we did. The first time we met was in Birmingham, Alabama, and Don Knotts was there. And we did an Andy Griffith reunion thing there. And Alan introduced me. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, Keith Richards." And so it's been great playing with the Rolling Stones for all these years. Still alive after all of it. But seriously, it's been a joy to know Alan and his wife, Jan, and through the years, and just all these wonderful people. And thank you for being here today. It's a great crowd. I can't believe you guys have made it out here, but thank you, Lord, for the sun that we can have a little bit of today. But I will be 72 years old this year. 72, little Ricky. 72, Johnny Paul, 72. How many people are I Love Lucy fans here? All right. Yeah, how many people are Andy Griffith fans? Yeah, my wife and I watch Andy Griffith every evening. Like, there's like two or three episodes that run in a row, so we'll catch that at the very early of the evening. But we love it. I mean, I just love that show. That show's so authentic, so funny. Don Knotts is hilarious, of course. And so I was honored to be on two of the greatest shows in television, the I Love Lucy show and the Andy Griffith show. And how I got to be on that show is I was raised in South Louisiana, having a name like Thibodeau. And I started playing the drums when I was 2 years old. I started on tin cans or metal trash cans in the backyard of my home in Bunky, Louisiana. We were living there at the time. I'm originally from Lafayette, Bro Bridge area. How many people like crawfish? All right, a few. All right, thank you very much. Well, that's the crawfish capital of the world is Bro Bridge, Louisiana. But anyway, I started playing the drums when I was 2 years old. And how I got known as that was our neighbor who lived next door to us told my parents, "I think your child is playing the drums outside." And they said, my mom said, "Oh, no, he just plays the pots and pans. And, you know, he's always making racket, you know." And she said, "Well, I think he's really making rhythm or making sense in the whole thing." And so they got me a little toy drum, and my mom and dad bought me a small drum, and it was a toy, and I broke it. And then eventually I said, "Dad, I want a real drum." So my dad started taking me to these Kiwanis Club meetings and Lions Club meetings in town, high school stuff. And they got me this little kid, and I would play the drums for him, and I was a hit. And so eventually this guy named Horace Height. Does anybody remember Horace Height? Anybody know who Horace Height is? He was a big band leader back in the 1950s. And he, very famous, he had the Swift Premium Hour, which actually came on an hour before the I Love Lucy show. So he had all these acts like, he discovered people like Art Carney. Remember Art Carney and the Honeymooners and all that? So he was a unique guy. And he had a show that came to Lafayette. And I was invited to come by my uncle, who said, you need to go to this, you know, this show that he's doing, because he's having a talent contest and he's featuring local talent. So I was one of the local talent that was on the show. And we arrived there. I played the drums. It was a big hit. And my dad went over to Mr. Height and he said, "Mr. Height," he said, "do you think my son has any future in show business?" And he said, "No, Mr. Thibodeau, I don't think your son does have any, you know, future in show business." And, you know, because we've already really got a 12-year-old drummer that's a regular on our show already. They had a little 12-year-old drummer that played. And I was just little, at that time, about 4 years old. And so they went on to call us 2 weeks later. 2 weeks later, I got a call from my dad got a call from Horace Height saying that they would like me to join their show as a regular. So here I was, this little four-year-old guy, going across the nation and across Canada, doing one-night stands with the Horace Hyde Show. So my dad left his job at United Gas Company and went on the road with me. My mom, two, my brother and my sister were still back home in Louisiana. And so here I was with a bunch of showgirls, a bunch of big band people, just doing all this, these drums as a little boy. And that show ended up in California. And so back in California, in L.A., the show, the Horace Hyde Show, was on hiatus, which means in hiatus, it means that the show takes a break, people relax, they regroup, and then they rehearse and they go out again. During this time, a friend of my dad found out about this interview that they were having down at Desilu Studios, and it just happened to be the I Love Lucy show was looking for a person, a little kid, to play their son, Little Ricky, because before it had been played by two sets of twins, or maybe even actually three sets, which were just, you know, the infants. They didn't have any lines on the show. They didn't play the drums. They just were infants, and they carried them around, and they were Little Ricky. So when I got on the show, they actually expanded the show and made more episodes revolve around their child, Little Ricky, and just things like Little Ricky gets to play the drums, Little Ricky gets stage fright, you know, some of these episodes that they featured me on. And it was always a great pleasure to be able to do anything that, that I could play the drums. Excuse me. Speaking of drums, I'm very sensitive to my drums back then. But anyway, so we would, you know, we would do these shows on the Al Lucy show. And anytime, you know, Lucy would always want to be on the show, and she would always want to be, doing some sort of a song and dance thing. So they incorporated me in this. And so I was able to play the drums. I was able to be a part of their family. But I really wasn't really an actor. I was just sort of thrown into that particular role because I looked like Desi or Ricky at the time, and I could play the drums. So that was one of the things that when I got on the set to try out for the show, Lucille Ball looked at me and my dad on the set, and she said, "Well, he's cute, but what does he do? What does he do?" My dad said, "He plays the drums." And she said, "Oh, come on." She goes, "Are you serious?" She goes, "Well, we have a set of drums over here. He can play those drums. Go over there and play those drums." So I went over there and played the drums. And, of course, you know, everybody started listening to me playing the drums as this little bitty boy who could play the drums. Sheldon Leonard, who was on Wonderful Life, he came over. He was a big producer. He produced shows like the Danny Thomas Show, the Andy Griffith Show, Sheldon Leonard, the bartender on Wonderful Life. And then finally, Desi Arnaz came over. And once he came over, he started playing with me. He got on the floor tom, started jamming with me on the drums and for a little while. And then he just kind of stood up and said, well, he laughed and he said, I think we found Little Ricky. And so they wanted to sign me to a 7-year contract with Desilu Studios. So here I was, this little boy from Louisiana who didn't know more than my name probably at that time, and I could play the drums. And I found myself on the most popular show on television, the Al Lucy show. What a blessing to be on that show. I got to know them not only on the show as an actor, but I also got to be best friends with their son and daughter, Lucy and Desi Arnaz Jr. So I was one of the few people that Lucy trusted, and she would have me come over on weekends, and I would go visit them in Beverly Hills and Del Mar, California. They had a beach house over there, and they had a ranch too. So Desi taught me and Desi Jr. how to fish, how to swim, how to ride horses. And, you know, he was a very, very generous person. Desi Arnaz was very generous. Lucy was more serious. She was very nice too. And they treated me like their son. They really did. So anytime they gave their kids any kind of presents or gifts or anything like that, they would always include me in on it. So Desi took, you know, us to the Rams game in L.A. and we would it was just a life that was so unlike my life in Louisiana. Our family lived in the valley, which was across the mountain over there. So we lived in the normal part of California, the San Fernando Valley. So when I'd go over to Beverly Hills, you know, I'd go to the area of Rolls Royces and Mercedes Benz and Jack Benny living next door and Jimmy Stewart about five doors down. This was kind of normal in Beverly Hills. But I saw in all of this, you know, I saw Lucy and Desi at their worst moments and their best moments. Some of the things that you know, you hear about their marital difficulties, Desi's alcoholism. I was firsthand on that. And we would, you know, I remember one time me and their kids were in the backyard of Beverly Hills, and this big, big yard in Beverly Hills, and big, big fence, big white, beautiful home, guest house in the back, pool, a little playhouse in the back as well that the kids could do their plays in. But Desi, at that point, Lucy were at sort of odds in their marriage to where they would have to live separately. So Desi lived in the guest house and Lucy lived in the main house. But one day we heard a lot of fighting going on, a lot of glass crashing, a lot of this going on, and we were just kind of hiding in the bushes. And it was just a sad situation to see them in reality, which was not really like the show. It wasn't really the Isle of Lucy show at home. It was another story. But very complicated, very talented, very amazing people, these people were. And I was amazed that I was able to be around these guys, but I was always, always in awe of these people. I know they have a movie about Isle of Lucy, or they have, you know, it was Nicole Kidman and Javier Bardem. People ask me, you know, what do I think of that movie? And I said, well, I mean, I find it hard to even connect with that movie because I actually lived that whole thing with them. So it was they were a little bit more complicated than the show. But it was a very, very interesting childhood being raised in that kind of situation, and knowing all the money, all the fame, all the power that they had, but yet they were very unhappy people, very unfulfilled people. So where to go from there? They got to the point where they were unable to work with one another on the show. So I was told by my dad that the show had ended. We did our last show. It was a show with Ernie Kovacs. It was an hour-long show, and one of the Lucy Desi comedy hours. And so my dad, as we were driving back, he said, "Well, Keith, you're out of a job." And I said, "Really? 9 years old? You know, I was this 9-year-old out of work, little actor, and I didn't know what to do with myself." So I went to the unemployment line, collected $65 a week, and I hated it because I was this little kid who just wanted to play baseball and football and just be normal. And I was standing with a bunch of unemployed actors and actresses and receiving a boring $65 check. But soon thereafter, the light shone, and I was able to secure a a job with the Andy Griffith Show. And they called me and they said, we want you to play Johnny Paul or whatever. So I said, great, you know. And so I had a smaller part on the Andy Griffith Show, Johnny Paul Jason, of which I really love. I love being Johnny Paul. I love that show. I love being a part of it. It was just like it was, the show was just like it was that you see. I mean, it was just a down-home show. And I would see Andy and Gomer and Goober and Aunt Bee and Opie. And we would just hang out. Me and Opie would hang out, play catch. We'd go down to the commissary. We'd see Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore a couple booths away. And it was just a fun studio lot. And we enjoyed each other. I think I enjoyed the Andy Griffith Show better because of the fact that I had somebody like Ron to play with on the show. And he was one of the nicest kids in Hollywood. I'd been, with a bunch of kids and worked with a bunch of kids in Hollywood, but he literally was not your stereotypical Hollywood child actor. So I very much enjoyed that. And unfortunately, my mother and dad had marital difficulties. My dad went out on my mother and was having an affair with a secretary at another studio. He had actually gotten a job at Desilu Studios. He was working with George Murphy, the famous actor, who was head of public relations there. And so he worked under there, and he'd go and hobnob and have dinners and entertain people, in public relations for Desilu Studios. He met this young, beautiful, blonde hair secretary, and ended up having an affair with her, and eventually had a child with her. She was pregnant. My mother found out about it one Christmas when we were going to get Christmas presents for our brothers and sisters, my brothers and sisters, and we basically dissolved as a family at that point. And I was the oldest of six kids, and it really hit me really strong about this time. I was 15 years old. How many people have come from broken homes in this place? Anybody come from broken homes? Raise your hands. Yeah. It's not a fun situation. It felt like my whole life was over with when my dad left my mom, and we had to move to Louisiana, which we were taken in by my aunts and uncles, and they took us in until my mother could find a job, because she was just basically a homemaker watching kids. So there in Lafayette, Louisiana, I went to high school, finished high school there, started playing with local groups and bands and rock bands about the late 1960s when the sex, drugs, and rock and roll stuff was happening, the flower child, the hippie movement, the seminal musical time in history, the Beatles, the British invasion. This was all part of the whole thing. In fact, speaking of the British invasion, Dino, Desi, and Billy was a group that Desi Arnaz Jr. was in. It was a pop group that Frank Sinatra helped them get started. And I actually sat in for Desi one night at a party in Truesdale Estates, which is a very, very ritzy area of Hollywood. And it was a big producer's home. And so Desi had injured himself in a surfing accident. He said, well, Keith can play. So I ended up playing that evening, sitting in for Desi as Dino, Desi, and Billy, and got to spend the night at Dean Martin's house. And that was a bit of a trip there to do that. Sat around just eating dinner with Dean Martin, and it was pretty amazing. But so in Louisiana, playing with rock bands and whatnot, started getting into smoking and drinking, and finally started doing LSD and just about any kind of drug you can think about. I did, because my friends did it. And I participated in that until I was, you know, probably in my early 20s. But I met a group called David and the Giants during this time when I was 16 years old in Biloxi, Mississippi. They were the house band at a vapors club, which was a big vapors club, which had acts like Jimi Hendrix and Little Richard and people like that. And they were there, and they were the house band. And so my manager for the little band I played with in Louisiana, we asked, you know, to sit in with David and the Giants so that they could try my band out. So I went up there and started playing drums with David the Giants, and they just looked at me and said, well, this kid's not going to be able to play the drums. He's, because I was always short for my age, like I still am short for my age. Kinda. Short jokes. We don't do short jokes. But anyway, they were amazed that I could play the drums like I did. And so I ended up having a friendship with this band, David and the Giants, and just for years until now. I was 19 years old, and David called me up and said, Keith, love for you to join David and the Giants. And I said, great, because at this time I was on LSD. I was just trying to leave town because I felt like the police were after me. I really just kind of left God in my life and just took a detour. And this detour was terrible. And after playing with David and the Giants for a couple of years, things just got to be worse and worse. And in my life, and I began to have a thing called clinical depression, which is what is sort of talked about now. I didn't know what that was. All I knew was that I was just feeling terrible. I was feeling like I was at the end of my life. I would hear voices in my head telling me to throw myself out of my sports car going 120 miles an hour down the interstate. And I would hear these you know, demonic type things that would just day and night, just making things torturing me. So I went to a roadie in the band, and I said, man, I've had these thoughts that I want to kill myself. And he just kind of was a little shocked, but he said, well, you know what you got to do, Keith? And I said, well, what? He said, you just got to get tough. You just got to pull your boots up and just do it, you know, just get through it. So it wasn't much help to me. And I ended up really just crying out to God one night. And I was in my waterbed in Laurel, Mississippi, which is where we were living with David and the Giants. And I just cried out to God, and I said, God, if you're real, I know I've made a mess of my life. I did all kinds of things. I got into demonic things. I got into satanic things. I dated witches. I did all the things that I blamed my dad for, adultery, all these things. I actually did all these things. And I was a part of these things, and I made a mess out of my life. And I was going to be like one of these child star stories that you hear that don't end up so well. I would have been, if it wasn't for God in my life, I would have ended up just either dead or in a mental institution, one of those two things. And I would have been long forgotten. But because of his mercies, he heard me that night. I said, God, if you're real, save me out of this mess that I made in my life, and I'll serve you. And 2 weeks later, my mother invited me to a meeting. We were raised Catholic. I was invited to a Catholic charismatic meeting, which is basically people looking for a deeper walk with the Lord. And for healing and other things that were happening at that point in the name of Jesus. And anyway, to make a long story short, I had a vision of Jesus, which really changed my life. And I talk about it in a book I wrote, Life After Lucy, which was published back in 1994. And I talk about the Al Lucy show, and I talk about the Andy Griffith show, and I talk about that too. I don't have any more of those books, but I do have them on Amazon. I don't have them on Amazon, but you can get them there. If you're interested in that. But anyway, so being invited to this Catholic charismatic meeting and having this vision of Jesus, I went back to the band that I was playing with, David and them, and I said, Jesus did a work in my life. And they said, great, great, wonderful. And they said, that's great. I said, well, look, guys, we got to change our music. We got to change the direction of our music. We've got to play music. We could still play rock and roll, but let's change the lyrics to more godly lyrics. And Desi looked at me David looked at me, of David and the Giants, and he said, well, that's good for you, Keith. And, I don't know if we'd make any money doing that. This was back in 1974. The Christian music, Christian rock, Christian worship music obviously was not around. So this was something new. And so he said, well, you get over this in about 2 weeks after you get off these drugs that you're on. So they just really thought I had a drug experience. But it was a reality of the Lord that touched my life. I repented of my sins during that vision. And the Bible opened up to me. I began to see the light. I began to see that I had a purpose in life. There was a reason for me being in this world, which I'd sort of left behind after, I had all these demonic voices in my head telling me to kill myself. And then I wasn't worth anything. But so anyway, eventually David came to the Lord. The whole band came to the Lord several years later. We became a Christian band, David and the Giants. And then the light of my life, earthly life anyway, came into my life. And it's my beautiful wife, Kathy, who's here today. And we've been married almost 46 years. And I met Kathy, would you please see if anybody wants to see this beautiful girl. Yep, I met Kathy. And we have a story. We have our own story about how we got married, which anybody interested in how we got married? No? I know the women are. Well, all right. I had an experience with the Lord. I repented of my sins. I didn't go to church anywhere. I didn't want to go to the Catholic church. I wanted to go to the true church because I knew that there were some things in the Bible about Catholics. If there's any Catholics here, I love you. But I looked at the Bible and I thought, well, this just doesn't make sense. So I didn't go to any church at that point. So I started to have a relationship with Kathy. I met her at a David and the Giants concert. And we began to live with one another for a couple of months. And then the Lord began to deal with me. And he said, I needed to marry her. And so I said, well, she came from a broken home. I came from a broken home. She was raised a United Methodist. I was raised a Catholic. She didn't really have a really strong relationship with the Lord. I had an experience with the Lord that changed my life. And we went and I said, look, if God wants us to be married, let's do that. And take this Bible, go to the other side of the room. It was the old Living Bible. Anybody remember the Living Bible? And we'll pray and we'll ask God to give us a sign whether we should get married or not through this. If you point, close your eyes, point, open up the Bible, point to the scripture, whatever it says, we're going to do. So she goes over to the other side of the room. She opens up the Bible. She closes her eyes and she points to the scripture and it says, I said, what does it say? I was really nervous. And she said, it is I, Ruth. Make me your wife according to God's holy law. It was in the book of Ruth. And so we got married that night. We eloped. We eloped. And so that was, I don't recommend anybody doing that. Okay? Just as a, Don't do that. But God had mercy on us. He respected our childlike faith. And so things began to change when I married my wife. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and favor from the Lord. And so that's what happened. We have a child. She's now 43 years old. We have one child, Tara. She lives in Phoenix. We have a grandson, Bryson, one grandson. He'll turn 8 years old in May. And his dad is a basketball coach at Grand Canyon University over there, which is a great Christian college. He used to coach at Valparaiso, and then later on he coached at Vanderbilt, Bryce Drew. But we don't want to talk about Vanderbilt right now, because that wasn't a good thing. If anybody knows that, but anyway. Anyway, my life has changed. I'm blessed. I am a new creature in Christ. I went on to not do the things that I used to do. I went on to do other things. Me and my wife also started a ballet company, a dance company called Ballet Magnificat, which is America's premier Christian ballet company. My wife is a ballet dancer. And she's an award-winning dancer who won a silver medal back in the 1982 ballet competition in Jackson, Mississippi, which was, they usually hold that every 3 or 4 years, one in Varna, Bulgaria, one in Moscow, one in Helsinki, Finland, and then in Jackson, Mississippi. So go figure why they say Jackson, Mississippi as the one of the arts capital of the world. I have no idea. But she was a local girl who won a silver medal, and God blessed her with that. And so in that she won that silver medal, she did a song called We Shall Behold Him by Sandy Patty, which is a great worship song about Jesus coming back. They didn't want her to do that because it was a communist. They had heavily communist judges in there from at that point, China and Russia, who were at that time communist. And still are, China. But they didn't want her to do it because they said that they would judge against her if it was a Christian song. But she said, no, I'm going to do it anyway. If I'm going to be in this competition, I'm going to do this anyway. Anyway, to make a long story short, she still won a silver medal in that prestigious worldwide event. And Mikhail Baryshnikov won the gold, to tell you what kind of event that is, in one of those competitions just like that. So we started a company called Ballet Magnificat, and it travels all over the world. We've been to over 43 countries. Kathy and I have been blessed to be able to go to Israel, China, Singapore, Czech Republic, Brussels, South America. We started a company and a school and a program in South America, and we're just amazed at what God has done and how he's changed our lives. Kathy's has been, you know, like we've been married almost 46 years, and she actually came to the Lord in a deeper way at one of David and the Giants concerts after we became a Christian band, and that was a unique story in itself. But so we really have a heart to praise His name with music, to praise His name with the dance. I still play with David and the Giants. In fact, we almost came here this year and played here with the band, but it didn't work out. But I really do want to thank Randall, and I want to thank the city of Granville, and I want to thank the 400 citizens of Granville, I believe that there are, and all the different volunteers that helped put this together. It's been amazing, and what a blessing and an honor to be able to still come and do things like this, Andy Griffith Show things, and I Love Lucy Show reunion type things. But you see, I'm the last surviving member of the Lucy Show, so there's not very many reunions going on.
So I hope you guys enjoyed that. As Keith Thibodeau, I know it was pretty long. This is a long episode, but I didn't want to cut the episode with Keith. I want you to be able to see the honesty, the his heart that he's putting out there. And I realize it's not all Andy Griffith Show related, but he is a product of the Andy Griffith Show and I Love Lucy and Desi Lou Studios. And it's just I thought his story really touches your heart. It really goes and does that. So, hey, I just want to thank y'all for sticking it out. So I also want to mention we have a sponsor, obviously, for the Two Chairs No Waiting podcast. And so it is Weaver's Department Store, folks. I want you to head over to Weaver's Department Store and check it out. And while you're over there, you might want to pick up the I Love Lucy oversized trading card. Yeah, see how I tied that into Keith. You can get that if you enjoy the I Love Lucy show. And if you, while we're talking about other shows, you might want to check out Dreama Denver, the wife of Bob Denver. She has a great book over at Weaver's called Gilligan's Dream, The Other Side of the Island. It's great about Bob Denver and her. So it's definitely something you might want to check out. Just head over to Weaver's Department Store, and most everything there is Mayberry related, but you might find some stuff that you didn't know about. Weaver'sDepartmentStore.com. So there you go. So hope you guys don't mind that too much. Now we're going to go in here from a spirit walker with a returning to Mayberry. So enjoy this. Take it off there, spirit walker.
Won't you turn on the Andy Griffith Show? Forget all your cares and woes. Sit back, relax, and laugh with friendly folks you know. Take up your fishing pole.
Welcome to Returning to Mayberry with special correspondent Spirit Walker from the Andy Griffith Show Esquire Club.
Thanks, Randy. Hello, Mayberry Spirit Watchers. Welcome to the Esquire Club, where we are proving that everything returns to Mayberry by taking a person, place, or thing from Mayberry, connecting it to something outside of Mayberry, continuing the connections around until something returns to Mayberry. Now, in our last segment, I did a Spirit Watchers Connections segment in which a Mr. F did two connections for us, and the last thing he had returning to Mayberry was George Goober Lindsay. In my last personal segment, the last thing I had returned into Mayberry was also a person, and that being Howard Hessman, who was then billed as Don Sturdy in two episodes of The Andy Griffith Show. Now, here's the kicker. Both George Goober Lindsay and Howard Hessman as Don Sturdy appeared in the 22nd episode of Season 8, Goober Goes to an Auto Show. So we're going to start with that segment and connect both my connection and Mr. F's connection to the same person. In Goober Goes to an Auto Show, Goober hooks up with his old friend Roy Swanson at an auto show in Raleigh. The two old friends try to outdo each other by bragging about how far each one of them has advanced since they attended trade school together. And in the process, they approach the hot dog counter and buy a hot dog from the counter boy, played by Howard Hessman, of course, billed as Don Sturdy. The actor who played Goober's friend, Roy Swanson, was played by Noam Pitlick. Pitlick was an actor and director born in Philadelphia in 1932. He directed episodes of many popular TV shows like Barney Miller, Taxi, One Day at a Time, Night Court, and Wings. He appeared as an actor in many different shows, including playing both Allied and German characters on Hogan's Heroes. He also appeared in two episodes of The Monkees, starring the Prefab Four, Michael Nesmith, Peter Tork, Mickey Dolenz, and Davy Jones. We know now that The Monkees were not a real rock group when the TV show began. In fact, only Nesmith and Tork were real musicians. And for that reason, studio musicians were used to lay down the tracks for the band, and they released their first single, Last Train to Clarksville, months before the first episode of the TV show aired in September of 1966. Their first complete album was released a month later and stayed at the top of the Billboard charts for 13 weeks. It took a lot of great musicians to create number one hits, and the Monkees had three of them. One of the best guitar players of his day was a regular on the Monkees' early recordings. His name was Barney Kessel. Kessel was a first-call guitarist for studio, film, and television recording sessions. He was a valued member of the studio musicians' band known as The Wrecking Crew and played music on albums for some of the biggest names of his day, like the Monkees, the Beach Boys, and Sonny and Cher. Once after a 2.5-hour session to record a one-chord song called The Beat Goes On, Kessel is reported to have stood up and proclaimed, "Never have so many played so little for so much." Another popular and talented session guitarist was Herb Ellis. Ellis had played for many great performers himself, such as Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong. He even accompanied Fred Sanford as he sang on an episode of Sanford and Son. Ellis joined two other popular guitar players to form an ensemble called the Great Guitars. The other two guitarists, well, they were Charlie Byrd and Barney Kessel. I said all that to say this. When Earl Hagen, the music director for the Andy Griffith Show, went looking for a guitar player to record the music for the character Jim Lindsay in the third episode of season one, the guitar player, he looked in their direction. We all know that James Best, who played Lindsay, did not play the music heard on the show. He pantomimed it. Later, when James Best was asked who did the actual playing for him on the show, Best said that he thought it was Herb Ellis. However, when Earl Hagen, the actual music director for the show, was asked, he stated that it was Barney Kessel. So fine. It doesn't matter which one of them did it. I'm returning Mayberry on both of them, since Earl Hagen used them both to record several music pieces for the show. I'm returning to Mayberry on the music of the Andy Griffith Show, which was second to none. So the circle is complete. From Howard Hessman and George Lindsay to Noam Pitlick and Mayberry, from Noam to the Monkees, from the Monkees to Barney Kessel, from Kessel to Herb Ellis, from Kessel and Ellis to Earl Hagen, and back to Mayberry as the music from the Andy Griffith Show. And so there you have it. From the car men to the guitar men, everything returns to Mayberry. Hey, drop me a line at the Andy Griffith Show Esquire Club with your connections, and I'll see if I can showcase them on the segment. So, until next time, thanks for being here. I appreciate it. And keep spreading that Mayberry spirit. I thank you.
It's so fun to spend some time with all these dear old friends of mine. Have a bottle of pop. Come on, let's watch the Andy Griffith Show.
All right, so there it is, Spirit Walker returning to Mayberry. Thank you. And if you want to make sure you don't miss out on some of the stuff he's doing, head over to facebook.com/groups/TAGS Esquire Club. And you can find the link to that in our show notes if you don't want to see. You can head over to the twochairsnowaiting.com and look at the show notes. There's a link there to that. So thank you, Spirit Walker, and thank all of you for being there. I want to thank Keith Thibodeau for being at Granville and for being able to – I'm so glad I was able to share that with you guys. We'll go back real quick. I know if you're still here, thank you for still being here. Keith, the reason I called him Keith Richards is because during the run of the Andy Griffith Show, the stage name that Keith Thibodeau used was Richard Keith. So it was Richard Keith. And I got Richard Keith and Keith Richards in my head. And I said the wrong one when I introduced Keith. And it was at an event in Birmingham, Alabama, in the Birmingham Civic Center, with Don Knotts, Keith Thibodeau, Eleanor Donahue, and I believe the only other one was Betty Lynn. I think there was just the four. But I had to MC it that night because David Browning, who was the Mayberry deputy, Barney, he was unable to attend. It was back in the early 90s, mid 90s when this was. And it was the very first thing I ever had to interview. And I messed up Keith's name on the stage in front of an entire civic center full of people. So, yeah, I have never forgotten that. Keith said, "That was you?" And I said, "Yeah, it was me." He said, "I'd have forgotten who it was." I said, "Well, I haven't." That's what I told him. So there you go. So Keith is a wonderful man. I hope you really enjoyed it. And I hope you enjoyed the podcast tonight. I would love to hear from you. You can give me a call at 888-684-8415. Or you can email me at floyd@imayberry.com. If you can't remember any of that, head over to twochairsnowaiting.com and you can figure out how to contact me from there. I love hearing from you guys, and I thank you for staying here, especially if you're still here. And I want to thank all of our Patreon supporters who support the podcast. Thank you very much. Without you guys and the folks that support the show, we wouldn't be here. So I really do appreciate all that you do to keep the show going, and just, you know, it humbles me, and I thank you for your support. So until next time, everybody, have a great Mayberry week, and we'll see you right here on Two Chairs. Good night, everybody.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.